All right, so I want to talk about how we can maximize what we are learning from implementation research in order to do a better job with improving kids' mental health and mental health services. And the subtext for this is getting the right picture. So I am working on my flying, my pilot's license, and I'm soloing, flying small planes, working towards private pilot license, and pretty close to it. But one of the things, there's lots of stuff I've learned. One is that it really keeps you very, it's a good antidote to the ethereal conceptualization that we get into in psychology, where we're thinking grand thoughts, because you've got to pay real attention to exactly where you are, what you're doing, and take in all the information from all the senses. And so you've got to be getting the right sight picture, especially if you're soloing. So you've got to be looking at that horizon line, looking at the nose, the cowling, seeing how it is lined up with the horizon line, and then just briefly scanning the instruments inside. You can't spend too much time in the cockpit. So getting the right sight picture, how can we do that given what we are learning from the evidence base on children's mental health, from implementation science, which is doing a tremendous job of informing some of our knowledge base, but it's not making the progress that we need. So how can we do a better job? I have nothing to disclose. I'm a very simple woman, actually, despite appearances to the contrary. The key points. I've been in this field basically about 30 years, and the prevalence of mental disorders among kids is growing. We are continuing to have problems with the gap between service use and service need, and I'm getting tired of talking about that, to be honest with you, and I'm sure many other people are too. You know, we're saying the same thing over and over again. The evidence base is robust. There's plenty that we know. The healthcare policies are offering new opportunities for doing a better job. But our implementation research is misaligned. We don't have the right sight picture, I would argue. And I want to talk specifically about what I mean by that in terms of five dimensions. So briefly, I don't need to belabor this because you all know this, the healthcare context with the Mental Health Parity Law, with the Affordable Care Act. But I work in a state. I have, as Barbara mentioned, a joint position with the state and with academia. And so paying attention to the impact of healthcare changes on the states and the state deficit is really important. So what's the impact of this? Well, managed care is in about 90% of the states or taking over very, very quickly. Mental health is being put under the umbrella of health in general under states, so it's having to assume a new position and doing some jostling in terms of authority and responsibility. That means with managed care concern, with costly services, with access, with high-end users. And so that has also been a bit of a shift from before. There's also at the same time, though, attention to prevention and how can we avoid costs down the line by paying attention to doing things early on, which is a really good thing for those of us in the child field. And then the workforce shortages. We know they're just, this is constant. We're never going to have enough people to do the work if we look just to the guilds to supply us with the workforce. So the fiscal realities, since the 2008 recession, the states have been struggling with workforce shortages, struggling with the continuity of services, having to deal with the budget cuts, and at the same time dealing with these major transformations that are taking shape as managed care is taking over the responsibility for the services, and our agencies and clinics need to learn, in many cases, how to contract with managed care organization in order to stay in business, in order to be able to provide the specialty services or their niche services. So it's creating a huge amount of pressure on agencies, on clinics, and on state systems. I can't overemphasize just how disruptive and at the same time, disruptive and transformational, I would say, this is for the state system. So the implications for the states I have just told you about. So what do we know about children and adolescents at risk? Well, we've known this for a while. Again, as I said, we're sort of tired of giving the same stats. But 4 to 8% have significant disabilities. About 30 to 40% have some kind of behavioral, mental health, or learning problems. What do we know about need and use of services. Well, about a quarter of children, according to the National Comorbidity Study, have a mental disorder with impairments that are significant enough. And the prevalence of all the disorders for children, especially the low-income kids, and I'm going to be talking more about that, has been growing about 40% from 2001 to 2010. I've just rotated off an Institute of Medicine committee that was set up by the Social Security Administration to look at supplemental security income for low-income kids. And so we looked at Medicaid data, we looked at Social Security data, we looked at national data insofar as it exists for kids. A really important report that I would draw your attention to. But one of the things we found was the prevalence is increasing over time for children with behavioral mental disorders. There is a little bit of good news in that service use among kids in the public sector is going up. So we are seeing some increase in the use of services, but the bad news is that there's no real evidence that the quality of those services is improving. So one of the ways in which we have looked at that, my colleague Eric Bruns with Ted Lutterman in the NASHVIT National Association and the National Research Institute, is to look at data about the use of evidence-based practices in the adult side and the child side, and to see what types of evidence-based practices are states using, and what's the penetration of those given the population that they're serving. And so there are a number of states that are indeed trying to support, through training, consultation, et cetera, the use of very specific evidence-based practices. For children, it's not as many as for adults, but there are a handful of those. But if you look at the penetration rates, it's less than 3% of the population of adults with serious mental illness are actually receiving those treatments. And for children, it's even less, 2.5%. Now that's ridiculous. I mean, come on, that is ridiculous. That is such a tiny percentage of the proportion of kids and families and adults who need evidence-based practices. So to me, this is kind of mind-numbing. We have this evidence base, and it has been growing. NIMH tripled its funding between about 1990 and 2000 for clinical services and preventive interventions for both children and adults, but for concentrating on kids right now. So tripling the funding on evidence-based practices, and lo and behold, it worked. I mean, we've really got a robust number now of both clinical treatments and preventive interventions. But the issue is that those evidence-based practices aren't getting used. And so that is the big conundrum that we're facing. We even now, thanks to the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, we have data now about the benefits over costs for some of these evidence-based practices, so that policymakers can say, all right, if we invest in this, these are the costs that we can expect to save down the line. And so this is a very careful analysis that's been done by Washington State Institute for Public Policy. So why the lack of progress? You know, what gives? Prevalence is rising, need use gap, but inequality is low. So why can't we get outside of this vortex that we seem to be stuck in? Well, part of it is that there are these tired academic models and the 17-year gap. And what I mean by that is the 17-year odyssey that the Green and others have shown for priorities for research funding, and then the peer reviews, and then the academic steps that you need to go through, and the publication, and then you synthesize it, and then maybe the professional associations will develop some guidelines, and then maybe those guidelines will be used, or maybe not. It's about 17 years. That's too slow. You know, the world is changing as we speak. We can hardly, you know, stand upright because things are moving around so quickly. So that's one problem. Another is the impractical interventions. So a lot of these interventions are just not something that the clinics that we're working with can adopt. They're too timely, they're too burdensome, they're too time-consuming. There's the current estimate by some treatment developers for changing an organizational culture is 3 years. So you've got to go 3 years into an agency in order to change their organizational culture. That is totally impractical. In 3 years' time, you will have a completely new staff because of the turnover, et cetera. Lack of attention to the business case, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but that to me has been a major setback, and one of the reasons that we're not making as much progress as we could in the clinical knowledge base is because we're not paying attention to the implications from a fiscal standpoint. And then from the implementation research standpoint, our work, by and large, if you look at what NIMH has been funding, is about frameworks and development of more frameworks. And good grief, we've got more frameworks in implementation science than I think in any other field. Focus on barriers. 90% of the program announcements from NIH are focused on barriers, facilitators to implementation. Or they're focused just on programs. Take this program, put it into place. What's going to, you know, how can we maintain the fidelity? If we want to make changes happen more quickly, I'm going to argue that we need to be focusing on social policies and implementing social policies within communities. And we can take some of our implementation science, our best thinking, and our evidence-based practices and have bigger impact, more rapid impact, and I think more robust impact. So that's going to take concerted effort and a lot of work from all of us. So I'm very fortunate to be able to head up the Ideas Center, and that acronym actually does stand for something. It took us a while to work it out, but it's Implementation and Dissemination of Evidence-Based Practices Among States, IDEAS. And it's funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. We were very fortunate to get this center, Advanced Services Research Center, focused on children and adolescents in state systems, at the same time that the Office of Mental Health gave myself and Mary McKay, my good colleague at NYU School of Social Work, a technical assistance center to focus on improving the services and the trainings for our workforce, for the agencies and the clinics in New York State. The CTAC, as we call it, includes now some of the adult clinics, and it includes some of the specialized services like residential treatment, etc. I'm just going to be focusing today on our children's TAC, our original CTAC, and the kids system, but we are broader than that. So the Community Technical Assistance Center has, from the beginning, because we brought on board people that came from the agencies, from the workforce, we didn't bring on the academics, you know, egghead types like myself. We brought on people that really had come from the ground. And we knew that we were going to have to pay attention to the fiscal realities that the clinics were facing. And so we have spent quite a lot of time working with the National Behavioral Council and with others to develop specific trainings on open access, centralized scheduling, concurrent documentation, productivity, and we're able now to map the 346 clinics in terms of the degree to which they have been participating in any of these business practices. So we've been able to be quite specific about that, but we also know that the clinical services need help as well, that our workforce, which are largely social workers, are not trained on evidence-based practices. They're doing whatever they were trained to do, but the evidence-based knowledge base has not been part of the clinical workforce training either. So we've had these two foci, the business case and the clinical training, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. The CTAC offers a range of trainings through webinars, learning collaboratives, in-person trainings, etc. And as I said, we've focused on some very specific business models that the clinics can volunteer to participate in, and it is voluntary. So we are able to get from OMH lists of those clinics that they feel are most financially fragile. And we have many of these clinics and agencies coming to us and saying, we want to participate, we need some help, we know we need some help. And so we offer a range of supports for them. Just to give you a sense, these are real data, a sense of where the clinics are starting from. This is a few years ago with 10 clinics that participated in a learning collaborative. If you just look at the yellow line, this is about the ratio of billable hours to paid hours. Now, I am not a business person, but I know that you're supposed to be able to bill and collect, you know, and those are supposed to be the same. You bill for something that you've delivered and you collect the payment for it. So this is the ratio of billable hours to paid hours, and the yellow is the target. So in an ideal system, everybody would be targeting 100%, right? You're deliver this service and you should be paid for that service at 100%. Well, first of all, they were more realistic and realized that they were not always going to be able to collect on everything. So the yellow line is what their target was, which is pretty much all below 100%. The green line is what they actually collected. And you can see that all of them, except for two, are below 50%. So they're collecting 50 cents on the dollar. They're paying out more money than they're collecting in. It's a hemorrhage situation. And this is real data from a group of clinics. And it's a reality for these clinics who are trying with all good intentions to do the very best job they can, but their business model is needs a lot of help. So that is the context that we're working in. And with that in mind, we have launched a series of research studies to try to help connect up all of these dots. We've got 24 going on right now, and I'm just going to talk about a couple, but this is where we have the support from NIMH to take some targeted problems and try to study those. And because our desire is to make it policy relevant and help the state, we've been looking for where those touchstones are. So I'm going to talk about two specific examples just to give you a little more of a grounded sense of what we're up to. And then I'll talk about where I think we need to go next. So one is this question about which of these clinics participating in the CTAG, serving children and families, which are the ones that are adopting the trainings of what type, and what predicts whether or not they're going to sign up, raise their hand for participation in a business oriented kind of training or in a clinical training. So we wanted to characterize the uptake, and part of the reason for that is that the state was saying, we don't really know what to do. We know that the clinics need help. We're throwing these trainings out there, but is there a better way for us to decide how to tailor the particular trainings for the needs of the clinics? So it was with that in mind we wanted to identify what is predicting the use of different types of trainings and help the policymakers decide. And the cost of these trainings are not cheap, by the way, either. So there's a reason to wonder about this. So we were able to characterize on the basis of the 346 clinics the adoption of the different offerings from CTAG in terms of number, intensity, type, and then whether they were just participating in a lunch and learn webinar, which is a pretty easy, you know, low-hanging fruit kind of thing, doesn't take a whole lot of time, versus an in-person training where there would be a little bit more of a commitment of staff time, et cetera, versus participating in a learning collaborative. Now that takes even more of a commitment on the part of the agency leadership and staff. Or that we have these super adopters, you know, they're like the good kids in the front row, you know, you know, they're raising their hands for everything, and they, yeah, Mary and David, you know. they just want to do everything because they're so enthusiastic. So we looked at number of trainings, intensity, and types of trainings, and basically what we found is about a third of the clinics of these 346 didn't sign up for anything. And this was just 1 year's time, and this is now about 3 years old, so it probably has changed, but I don't have data to show that it's changed. But about a third didn't sign up for anything. We have since gone back to figure out why. But of those that did, most of them, not surprisingly, were participating in the sort of low-hanging fruit of a webinar, smaller percentage in those that required more intensity. But we wanted to look at what is predicting the responses to the trainings in terms of business practices or clinical trainings. And so we were able to collect data from the state, integrate that data with what we had from the CTAG, and then look at some of the agency level variables as well as the bigger extra-organizational variables to see what seemed to be predictive. And the short story here is that there were some differences between the clinics that signed up for business versus clinical. The clinics, the agencies, clinics and agencies that were larger and more efficient and that did more outsourcing, so the percentage of clinical staff contracted out, were less likely to engage in the business practices. Mm. Those that were hospital-based and had fewer clinical staff, the bottom red, had higher odds of participating. So hospital affiliation and fewer clinical staff, you're more likely to participate in this. But if you're big, you can sort of absorb some of these costs. If you do a lot of outsourcing for the clinical work, then the business model wasn't as important to you because you were doing okay. So that was interesting to us. When we looked at what predicted the use of the clinical trainings, there what we found was that the more FTE clinical staff and the younger the population, the more likely they were, which also makes good sense. I mean, this is not, you know, earth-shattering. But what's important here, I think, is that just increasing the sheer number of trainings is unlikely to improve the adoption. And that is usually the way the states tend to think of it. You know, let's just offer more and more. the bigger the better. And that, in essence, doesn't seem to be making a difference. It also seems as though those that are going to dig in to participate in something that's more time intensive, like a learning collaborative, are likely to have first sort of gotten their feet wet, dipped their toe in the water by going through a webinar first. And then there are differences in terms of those that need the business practices, those that need the clinical, and which ones they're signing up for. So it suggests that we can do a better job of tailoring the strategies for it. And we've used this with our CTAC center then to tailor the types of strategies for the particular clinics. Some of them need individualized consultation and some don't. So that's just an example of one way in which we're trying to make the research practical, frankly, and make it responsive to what the state needs. A second example, very different example here, is from the work that we've been doing with parent partners, and Barbara mentioned this work. I was so fortunate to come into a state that already had an amazing group of parent partners. And some of that, you know, Mary, I know you guys and David were working on long before I got there. So there were already a very active group of the Mental Health Association, family resource centers, parent partners, and these are parents whose kids have been in the mental health system who are dying to get involved and do some good and not have other parents go through what they went through, but to be able to help parents avoid some of that and to participate in the workforce. So we're very, very happy, very fortunate to be able to work with them to help develop a training model. We did that with NIMH funding support as well. We were able to test a particular type of training of the parent partners and to see if that was going to improve their ability to be efficacious, effective in working with parents. So we have this parent partners. We now have 400 who have been trained. This is a training program that has both the New York State as well as the Families Together certification. But what we want to do is get down to the ground now with what can we do with parent partners? What are the skills, competencies that are going to enable a parent partner within the workforce, within these clinics, do a better job of the work that they're doing on behalf of families? So working with, again, my colleague Mary McKay, we got an R01 from NIMH to study a multi-family group model. So this is 6 to 8 families of children with oppositional defiance disorder, by and large behavior problems, who are coming in New York City for services to the clinics that I was just describing, in order to learn how to manage their child's behavior better and in order to help these kids do a better job in school, etc. One of the reasons this was appealing to the clinics is because it is a group model, so there's a way in which to bill for that is going to be more lucrative than what they were doing before. So paying attention to, is this a clinical model that we're likely to be able to get off the ground because it fits with their own business practices? That was an important first question. So we were able to enlist the support, as I said, of NIMH and 390 parents over the course of the 5 years. We developed the multifamily group manual and training based on the same stuff that has been in the literature for years from Oregon Social Learning Center, Jerry Patterson. You know, we all know that work. So we borrowed heavily from that, but put it into a modality so it could be delivered with 6 to 8 families. These are low-income families in New York City, largely ethnic minority families, largely single family, single moms. And we developed it with the parent partners. So although it has all of the you know, the academic terms of child management, family communication, and interaction, and stress, when we ask our parent partners, you know, how are you going to be talking about this with the parents that you're going to be working with, what they came up with was 4 R's and 2 S's. Okay, that's nice and simple. And it captures the core elements of it. So rules, roles, respectful communication, relationships, stress and support. And so this is called by our parent partners the 4 R's and 2 S's. As I mentioned, it's low-income families, and 390 of them in New York City. And when we looked at the effect sizes at 6 months out, we found a fairly robust effect sizes across the board for both the effect on the parents as well as the effect on the children. We had about an 85% engagement rate for the sessions, and the sessions were all together. There were 16 sessions, but there was a lot of overlap among them because we knew parents aren't going to be able to come to all 16 sessions. So we had a I'm not sure what that term is. I'm thinking of a sewing, you know, when you sew and you do a cross stitch and you're going under. It was kind of like a rolling enrollment. So we would have 2 of the same session offered back to back. So if you missed the one, you could get it the next time around. So altogether, it was equivalent to 8 sessions, but it actually ended up being 16 to meet the needs of the families. But the point here is that we were able to find changes for both the child behavior problems as well as parenting, and we were really really looking for the parenting changes. You know, using the Alabama Parenting Questionnaire, we got an effect size that's quite robust and strong. When we just looked at specific oppositional defiance subscales over time, 6 months follow-up, again, we saw the differences between our control, and the controls are the clinics that we're working with that did not receive these services versus those that did get the multifamily group. So implications are that this paired team model, these are parent partners paired with a clinical social worker who are running these groups, that this paired team model seems to improve the family and child outcomes. It is billable, it improves the volume of services. But one of the things we found was that it was amazingly difficult for our clinicians to deliver this. It was highly stressful for the clinicians who, again, well-intentioned, well-meaning, but who were basically counting on no-shows in order to be able to get a breather. And instead, these darn families keep showing up. And they're showing up in droves, and they want the group model. And so running a group is very difficult. Running groups when everybody's showing up is even more difficult. So our clinicians were getting burned out, frankly. So we decided we were going to have to study this. We're going to have to do a replication, but also see, is there a way to lighten the burden on the frontline clinicians by providing some support on the ground through CQI teams, through additional support and consultation, and then be able to hand that over. So that is an implementation strategy. So we went back to NIMH. We were able to get a second R01 that has just been funded about 6 months ago, or just started in June. And we're going to be doing a hybrid implementation study. So those are just a couple examples out of the, you know, the 24 that we're doing. But the point is just that trying to make our implementation science more grounded and practical, but also scientific, is to me one of the biggest challenges, but also the important thing that we need to be working on daily. It's just not enough to try to be pristine and to keep our academic hats on and not pay attention to the reality of what's going on with these clinics. And so we are reminded of that every day, and I'm very grateful for it. We're reminded by our agency directors as well as by our parent partners. I have four parent partners now on my research team as part of the research staff, and damn, you know, they just keep me grounded all the time, making sure that the questions we're asking, the way we're asking the questions, the way we're interpreting the data is meaningful to the parents who are living the lives every day with kids who have needs. So how do we get the right sight picture? You know, going back to this notion of we're looking at the horizon line, we've got to line up the nose and the cowling, and we look at our instruments really quickly, quick scan, but we've got to keep our eyes focused out there. How do we get the right picture with implementation research in order to make a difference, a real difference, with kids' mental health needs and service use? What do we need to do differently? And I've come up with a few ideas. And I'm just thinking of them as five dimensions, because, you know, when you're in the air, it's three-dimensional space, but I think really physicists are saying there's probably 14 dimensions, so, you know, we'll split the difference, so five dimensions. So how could we do a better job with that? And I'm going to go through some of these. De-guild, drive with data, distill, democratize, and disentangle the social determinants. So de-guilding, I've already talked a bit about that. Using parent partners as part of the workforce is a way to de-guild. When I first started, you know, we in the psychology field would say, oh, we can't teach parents to do that because we're so special and only we know how to do this. Well, you know, it turns out that's not so true. And we have got a whole series of studies supporting, instructing, training family partners to do a whole range of things, including screening for maternal depression, as well as engagement training, as well as the multifamily group model I talked about, it, and there are many others. So there's a lot that could be done, and I think we need to take that much more seriously. To distill, so training alone is not going to be sufficient, even if we train up the wazoo, you know, train our clinicians on everything that we think is going to be an evidence-based practice for the population they're serving. It's still only going to account for maybe two-thirds of the children that are presenting in the mental health clinic. This comes from Bruce Turpita's work, where he took the NREP treatment programs, National Registry Effective Practices, for the most common disorders for kids in the clinics that he was working in, which is in Los Angeles, and found if you were to take a therapist, train them on eight of these evidence-based practices, the most common ones, you would still only be reaching about 69% of kids. Some of that is because kids are coming in with comorbidities. Some of this is because in midstream, some other issue comes up and you've got to adapt. Some of it is that our training materials and training models themselves are too rigid and are not really responsive to the changing needs of kids and families. But just adding in more and more training on evidence-based practices is probably not going to get us there. Okay, so Bruce Turpita and Eric DeLeiden have developed something called PracticeWise website and Managing Adapting Practice program. We are doing that in New York State right now through an evidence-based treatment dissemination center where we're training about 150 clinicians a year on the MAP project. This is an example of one of the ways in which Bruce has taken the evidence base that exists on clinical therapies, psychosocial treatments, and there are now over 750 that have been published over the past number of years. And this is taking the ones for depression, so treatment for depression for children, which are largely CBTs, cognitive behavioral therapies, and then looking at what are the practice elements within all of these manualized protocols, and are we finding some commonalities across them? So rather than training therapists on, oh, now there are 350 different manualized treatments when there's a lot of overlap, could we think about identifying some of the practice elements that are popping up across these manualized protocols and be able to train on some of these treatment elements? Now that's not the same as doing an evidence-based practice. And there are lots of reasons why people are sometimes uncomfortable with that, and I think it's worth our discussing. But the truth is, from the standpoint of saying, can we get our workforce to learn some of the techniques that are most commonly found in the evidence-based practices, and can we at least raise the bar a bit? I think it's worth our taking seriously. And so Bruce and company have done a comprehensive job of looking at the practices at the evidence base and distilling it into some of these common practice elements. And the training then is intensive, but it requires learning these elements, learning assessment practices, And then learning how to use data, which is my next issue. Learning how to use data to see whether or not the techniques and the elements are making a difference with kids. So it's using data in a real-time fashion in order to see whether or not change is happening. This is an example of a dashboard, and as part of the training we're doing on the evidence-based treatment dissemination, we train our clinicians on using a very simple dashboard system where they can choose what are the measures that they want to be able to track over time. This is for a child with social anxiety and depression. So there are symptom measures that are in blue. There are other symptom measures in red. Blue is for social anxiety. The red is for depression. And then you have the elements down the long list. And so what was the therapist doing? Well, they were doing exposure. Did we see a change in some of their SUDS ratings? Yes, we did, over time. Then on the right-hand side, you can add in your own homegrown kinds of measures in order to see whether change is happening. It's a way to use data to create a picture, to use evidence-based approaches, and to be able to put it all together to see whether or not you as a therapist are making changes, are seeing changes happen. And if not, then you gotta adjust. You know, then you're gonna use some other technique. You're gonna pull in some other resources. But it's a way to not get so hung up on, do we have this one program and this one model and it's being delivered with fidelity, but rather to think, how can we create a more flexible approach based on the evidence base? Okay, fourth point is democratizing access to innovation. So there's this great book that came out a few years ago now by Stephen Johnson, Where Good Ideas Come From, Natural History of Innovation. I've talked about it in a few other times because I really think he was able to look over time at innovative thinking and pull down some principles that I think are very relevant to where we need to be moving. My favorite, by the way, is the fail faster, because you know, we're failing all the time, you know, despite what Barbara said. We are failing all the darn time, but can we learn from it? Can we? So one of the things he did, you don't have to read all of this, but it's just kind of interesting to me that he came up with a 2x2, and it was, were these innovations either developed in order to be marketed or to be given away, so market or non-market, and then were they developed by an individual or by a group, by a network? And so the marketed individual, you had the printing press, you have hot air balloons, you know, it's developed for a particular purpose by an individual. Marketed network, well, the airplane, as a matter of fact, double entry bookkeeping was marketed, networked, a group of people. Non-market individual, World Wide Web, for example. Non-market networked, the internet. So I was just curious, looking over time, where do we see the biggest growth? Well, we see the biggest growth in the non-marketed networked. So in other words, those that are not developed to be sold, but those that are developed by to be given away, so open source, and those that were developed by multiple people at once, by a number of different people, and that's where we see the biggest growth. So why is this an issue for us? Well, because we are running into this question of proprietorship of particular treatments, programs, assessment measures all the time. We run this technical assistance center for the state. We want to improve the quality of the services, and yet there are certain kinds of treatments and preventive programs that are great on, if you look at the literature, and they have wonderful effects, but they're not affordable. So what do you do, you know, if you're working in this kind of position? What can we do? What should we do? So Stephen Johnson, again, said the best ideas come from networked associations with others in non-proprietary environments. Or to me, it harkens back to what George Miller said, give the tools of psychology away. This matters because if we were to look at the cost to one agency for training on 6 of the strongest EBTs for anxiety, depression, trauma, how much for one agency to train 8 therapists? Well, about between $160,000 and $190,000 for 8 therapists over a year. Are those 8 therapists going to be there at the end of the year? Probably not. this is the model that is going to be sustainable over the long haul. And that's not to say that treatment developers shouldn't be paid for their time, that they shouldn't be supported in maintaining the fidelity. Absolutely should. But can we think about other alternatives, other incentives to be able to support the sharing of data, sharing of information, use of programs, but also maintaining the fidelity? And so could we change the incentive system? Instead of the government incentivizing intellectual property, which it does now within academia, developers need to be paid for their time, but could we develop user agreements that are crafted so that agencies can use programs for free if they agree to share the data, and if those data are used for adaptations, et cetera? Could national funding agencies support open access and data sharing for implementation, maintaining an electronic repository? NIMH has done this for autism. It has an amazing library of resources, and it's because the autism advocates said, gosh darn it, we know there's a lot of data out there. We want access to that data. We want to be able to help our kids in our locality. NIMH has invested in developing a repository of all of the data, of all of the programs, of all of the research, and they make it available. There's a process, but they make it available. It's really a remarkable, wonderful kind of a resource, but it's only for autism right now. What about all the other disorders that our kids have and our families are facing? So we need to be thinking more creatively about this problem. I think it's a huge problem for the field. It's a huge impediment for us in terms of improving the quality of the services for children and families. And then the final point is disentangling social determinants, focusing on policies, not just programs. So as I mentioned, I just rotated off, and then Jane Costello was on the same committee with me from Institute of Medicine, which is now, by the way, called National Academies of Medicine, Engineering, and Science. We just rotated off this committee that was tasked by Social Security Administration to look at supplemental security income for kids. And so I think it's a very important report that looks closely at the relationship between poverty as a risk factor for child disability, and child disability as a risk factor for family poverty. There were a number of really thoughtful people involved in this report looking at those issues. At the same time, a book has just come out that Bradbury and others have written on the achievement gap in the United States for children ages 5 to 11, comparing the U.S. achievement gap in terms of social SES inequalities in the U.S. versus Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom. It's a fascinating book. They take national data from all four of those countries and look at the inequalities and what are the types of policies that might have been put into place to eliminate or at least mitigate some of those inequalities. So, for example, 60% of the SES reading gap in eighth grade is attributed to differences present at kindergarten in the U.S. And 40% is the result of children from different SES groups following different trajectories later. There's a lot of opportunity here for intervening, and we need to be thinking about the intervention at more of a social policy level. Some of the recommendations that they make are using evidence-based parenting programs, making those available. Why don't we make those available everywhere, in the WIC programs, in pediatrician offices? Why can't we just get those out there? Universal preschool programs. There are a few states, Oklahoma's one, there are a few others that are doing that, but why is it it's still only select states? And income support. And income support is part of the supplemental security income for low-income families of children with disabilities, and yet the way in which it's administered across the states varies tremendously, sevenfold differences between states. And this is a federal entitlement program to which all families of children with disabilities are entitled. And yet, depending on where you're living, you may or may not get it. That's not right. So should we be looking at income supports? These are examples of social policies. If our implementation research agenda was focused on studying these, and there are ways to do it, there are communities that are trying to do this, then I think we might be able to actually close some of these gaps that we're seeing with children's needs and services. I just want to bring attention to what I think is one of the most phenomenal studies that Jane Costello and her team did at the Great Smoky Mountain. And to me, it epitomizes how you can design a natural experiment with profound findings that we did cite in our Institute of Medicine report. And I just think it's important for us to pay attention to these again. And the basic, just the short story here, is that in the course of an epidemiological study in Great Smoky Mountain of children over time, to look at the proportion of those with mental health issues, psychiatric issues, within the casino, within the American Native population there, a casino came in, and that provided income supplementation to part of the sample within the Great Smoky Mountain study. Jane and colleagues were astute enough to realize this was an opportunity to look at the effect of income on psychiatric problems in kids among that subgroup of children. And so the second line there, the ex-poor, those were families who had been poor, casino came in, and they were given an income supplement. And then on the right-hand side, you see the total psychiatric symptom scores and the odds ratio. And basically, you see a significant decrease in total psychiatric symptoms. And the only thing that changed there that they looked at was the income supplementation. This is really profound when you think about it. It wasn't that there were more services. It wasn't that there were all these other things that happened. This was income supplementation to families. Social Security is aware of that. Other policy makers are aware of that. Nobody's quite sure exactly why this is. Is it because parents now have more time to spend with their kids? Is it that they don't have to have two jobs now? I mean, there's many ways to speculate about it. But to me, if we're going to be thinking about having a major impact to deal with the big problems I talked about first, which is the rising number of children with mental health problems and the gap between children with needs, children's use of services, and the quality of those services, we've got to take seriously these kinds of issues. So, conclusion, we've got a real opportunity here, you know, a real opportunity with healthcare reform, with communities that are transforming their services, in part because of managed care, in part because of the Affordable Care Act, et cetera. Many communities are undergoing major transformations, and they're trying to align things like substance abuse services, unemployment, housing, drug abuse, etc., with mental health services, with behavioral health services, and to do a better job at the community level to improve those services and to pay for them differently. So I think we have a real opportunity now, and to get in early, to do a better job and to study this. And if our implementation science agenda were studying these kinds of experiments that are happening, I think we would be able to learn a great deal more. So I would just think again about how we can get the right sight picture, how we can make sure we're paying attention to the most important horizon line there, and line up the rest of our science in a way that's going to really make a difference. And with that, I just want to thank you so much again for the award and for the opportunity to talk to all of you. Thank you.
So it all inspired and ready to go change the world. Kimberly promised to save time for questions, and she's open to whatever you'd like to ask.
I think the federal government could do a lot. I mean, one of the things that we've got right now is a whole series of different entitlement programs for kids. There's the Medicaid, there's the Social Supplemental Security, there's the IDEA from Department of Ed. So if we just look at children with mental health problems and the potpourri of federal programs, I think there needs to be a way to create better integration across those. I would love, if I were a czar for a day, to create one unified federal entitlement program for kids with mental health problems that would go from early intervention, prevention, all the way up, rather than these different programs that are then administered differently at the state level. So you start with differences federally. By the time it gets to the state, my gosh, you know, you've got such huge variations that it does not create the opportunity for us to be able to support in an efficient way the services that are needed, even though we really know to a large extent what is needed. So I think federal integration is one. The same is true with quality measures. I didn't talk a lot about that, but we've got all of these different committees that are developing quality measures that are used by managed care, by healthcare systems, to track progress. And yet, the way they're being designed, the way they're being developed, how they're being measured is all over the place. There's another example where we could come up with better alignment on our quality measures, both as a country as well as in healthcare entities, in order to make sure we're identifying what are the most important outcomes and we're pushing and tracking for those. Right now, there's so much noise that it's just chaotic.
Is there any gender? So we're talking about this idea about rethinking implementation plans. Who thinks like you? Where are the openings to talk about refining or reframing implementation plans to make it more practical?
Oh, I think there are a lot of people who are. There's the D&I, NIH has the dissemination and implementation group. Right. And so David Chambers, heads up now D&I at the National Cancer Institute. I think this is perfectly aligned with him. There's going to be a conference in DC actually on that. But I think what's happened is that we've got these implementation science group and then we've got quality improvement.
Yeah.
People, and they're not talking, and to me that makes no sense. And so we have implementation research becoming more and more academic and narrow. We have quality improvement being much more grounded, but not necessarily always using the best methods. And so I think there needs to be a bridge there, and I don't see that happening yet.
Well, on the QI side would be people that would be useful to talk to. If you ever find anybody on that side of that huge marketing industry, that would be.
Yeah.
Okay, somebody over there is thinking about it. The QI work that I've done, the QI work that I've done, we all know that there's something up. But we're not at a place to question the logic model behind it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Harold Pincus is doing a lot of work on that in the mental health field. He's very thoughtful on that. But it's going to take more than an individual person.
Well,
I know you know.
Like you said,
that's right. Back there.
A little bit more about the training of the parent partners and the qualifications.
The training of the parent partners and the qualifications. Sure, I'd love to. So our training comes out of social behavioral theory. It came from some work that NIMH did a number of years ago, pulling together Marty Fishbein, Albert Bandura, Triandus, the sort of gurus of social learning and behavioral determinants. They came up with a unified theory of behavior change, and it identified what do you need to do in order to help incentivize behavior to change. And so it's called the Unified Theory of Behavior. So we started with that, working with our parent partners, to come up with a series of very specific trainings that deal with things like knowledge about the service system, knowledge about what's the difference between a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a social worker, real basic stuff. What are the entitlements in schools, etc. How do you, as a parent partner, learn how to maintain boundaries? Because you are a parent and you've got things that you're dealing with on a daily basis. So how do you know how to professionalize the work, when to share that story, when it's helpful, when it's not? Do you give your phone number and then you're called 24 hours a day? No. So a lot around boundaries, and then a lot around just very specific skills, interviewing skills, engagement skills, how do you access the knowledge base. So sort of those three. We have about a week of training and then consultation by phone. It's very similar to the clinical training model that we do, that many of us do, where there's some in-person and maybe bookended with webinars and then some telephone consultation. The certification has been picked up by Families Together, and so in consort with ourselves and with OMH, after participating in this 6 months and using this behavior change model, which is called the agency of action, and showing that they can do that on the ground with real cases, then they become certified. Happy to share it. We've got all the all the data. And we do live by our word. Anything we develop is available for free to anybody. David, do you know?
I get a couple of things. I was really surprised by that dissemination. I would have guessed that if there was a marketing interest, somebody could make money out of it, it would attract me. So I thought that was really astounding in a way.
Yeah.
Very counterintuitive, at least from my perspective.
Yeah.
Because I felt often that part of our problem was that we did get everything away, and no one had kind of a stake in making sure it was kind of done properly. But there's something that kind of troubles me when you look at the effects of socioeconomic status on health and development, and it's just that they're just overwhelming effects. The change study is phenomenal, and what we're seeing now in terms of specific predictions about aspects of brain development that are particularly related to particular kinds of skills like verbal memory and the socioeconomic effect on that, it seems like a no-brainer somehow that we should really need to address that problem. Tell me a little bit about your thinking about how one would create the political will to do that. I mean, because I'm sort of struck by the fact that, you know, that we have got this sort of anti-immigration bias, the takers and the makers comments in the last election. There's this sort of mean-spiritedness from my perspective about helping poor people. Is there a way that, I know you think about this a lot, you thought about framing that in a way so it might have greater kind of public traction as a message?
It's a big question. The first thoughts I have are that the parent advocates are the ones who have the sort of best knowledge base about that. Even going back to the Social Security IOM report, one of the things we found when we looked at the state-to-state variation was that Pennsylvania was doing a really good job. Mm-hmm. They were identifying more families and the allowance rates for these families who had kids with mental disabilities was much higher than some other states. And when we thought back about the history, some of that was because that's where this program for kids and families started, and it was a group of advocates that were starting to raise questions about why do we just have this for adults? What about families of kids? And so I've been letting that be known in those state variations to our family advocates, because that was mostly the disability community. Mental health, I think, community has not always been aware of that. So I do think there's a role for family advocates in that. I'm not sure what the best language is for talking about this. There is an IOM committee on cognitive affective behavioral issues or development, and there's a group that's working on that. David Hawkins has been a leader in that, looking for some language around, for example, parenting, to be able to talk about it in a bipartisan way, but also in a way that just doesn't sound too jargony, because we get so caught up, you know? And I'm as guilty of that as anybody in our own jargon. So, I don't have a real direct answer, but I do think we've got to keep working on it. Yes?
Thank you, Dr. Lee. Very nice. My question is around children out of homelessness and foster care, and for kids that might not be
Well, we do. We have tried to build this model into the child welfare system itself, and that's been met with uneven success. In some places it works, in other places it doesn't. But a couple ways in which it seems to work. One is doing home visits, having parent partners just go into the home or go to wherever the family would, the parent or the foster parent or the biological parent would want. And it may be a church, it may be the grocery store, maybe the mall, whatever. So some of it is that, and then some of it is also adapting the model so that it's more almost team-based. So you have the biological parent, you have the foster parent, you have the caseworker. Sometimes we have youth advocates as well, and these youth advocates have a very different perspective from the family advocates. It's fascinating. They're not on the same page. But they have a really important perspective in terms of how to approach the youth, especially if it's an adolescent. So it takes a different set of sort of ways of thinking about it, but it's the same basic premise. Yes.
I had a question related to trauma.
Trauma.
And what your thoughts were around in terms of positions that we were talking about, selling and kind of taking the oral active pieces and incorporating those, and what your thoughts on in terms of how trauma and addressing trauma,
Yeah, it's a really important problem. Well, there have been a number of really well done randomized clinical trials on trauma treatments, and so there is, you know, a knowledge base. Some of it is for sexual abuse, physical abuse versus other kinds of things. I think that there's first of all we need to see where the knowledge base is. Secondly, see where there are some similarities to it. I worry that the trauma-informed care model is quite diffuse in terms of how it's defined, and it seems like it's almost becoming a new system of care language without groundedness. So there's not a good empirical base on that, so I worry about us getting so starry-eyed about trauma-informed care that we lose sight of what's the specific kind of model of treatment we're doing. That being said, though, we have the opportunity now to be working in Newtown, Sandy Hook, where the Sandy Hook shooting took place, to be able to look at how to build a system there that will be able to deal with the long-term trauma for families and kids. And so it's going to take a combination of both evidence-based approaches, but also new kind of community partnerships and a coalition of stakeholders who are saying we have got to get things right all together, and we've got to be using some data systems to track it. So I think trauma is something that, because it's so pervasive, and because our treatments are still pretty narrow, even though we have some, we've got to be thinking differently about systems, and it's not going to be as pat as trauma-informed care. So I think we have actually a long way to go, but I'm so glad to see trauma as having taken a foothold, because I think it's done a real service in terms of reducing a sense of stigma. Because if you have been traumatized, most people are going to say it's not your fault, even though it has all of these other issues associated with other sequelae. So I think there's a lot that we can be doing that we just haven't tackled yet. All right. Getting quiet. one more. Yeah. Oh boy, man. we've been looking at NIMH data actually over time to see where the money is going, and it's not a good picture, and it's not a surprise to anybody in this room, but it's going very much towards neuroscience, and the services intervention dissemination are just going downhill quickly. I think we need new leadership and vision at NIMH, frankly. I think that the number of states and communities that are trying to deal with these issues now in very innovative ways, Los Angeles, New York City's got a big initiative now, Philadelphia, New Orleans, I could go on and on. There are five states, the National Governors Association, five states that have come forward saying we want to develop a new children's mental health system. So there are all these opportunities now. I don't know if NIMH is going to be able to see this as an opportunity for supporting some of these experiments that can and should be done in the same way that the medical outcomes study years ago was done. But I think if it's not NIMH, maybe it'll be PCORI, maybe it'll be a foundation, maybe it's, we're going to have to put things together in a patchwork way for now. So I don't know how to change the direction of thinking at NIMH, but I think there's enough of a sort of tipping point of people saying, look, this is important work that's going on, and we've got to be able to study it much more carefully than we can without some real concerted effort. I think if enough people are calling for that, Congress is going to get it, and usually the pendulum does swing at NIH, so I'm hopeful it's going to happen, but I haven't seen evidence of it yet. They are, well, there's a combination, but the parent partners I hire, are you talking about in my research?
Yes.
Oh, they're paid. Oh, absolutely. Oh my gosh. No, they're research staff. The parent partners who are part of my team are research staff. The parent partners who are working out in the workforce, if they're associated with a program, and many of them are, they're paid. Yeah, it's a paid professional. There are also a group of unpaid family partners who are also very important to the work, but they're voluntary. But the ones I've been talking about are in the workforce.
So, typically, for parent partners, you had to relate your point about de-gilding. You've been at this for a number of years now. Have you seen a change in the perception of a paraprofessional by MSWs, PhDs, MDs in the mental health system? Because as we go into, get more into the ADA, and you see it right now, you see the journal health plan, you're going to get sort of right away to a, not a real case manager, to a care manager.
Right.
Case manager that we talk about in the old days. Are you seeing a change in perception and appreciation of their confidence and some of that?
Definitely, we are.
Could you summarize the question?
So are we seeing a difference in the perspectives of social workers, of the workforce, in addition to the parent partners, about the team-based approach, about the de-gilding issues? Is that what you're
talking about? Specifically about the peer specialists.
About the peer specialists.
Yes. I mean, here you're going to come in, you're going to think, I'm a PhD, I'm an MD, and I really do. So, overstating, but it's a concern.
Which
role are they assuming? And,
yes.
And maybe in fact, they're more effective than some of us with all our degrees.
So are we seeing a change in the perspective about parent partnership by people in the workforce? And there's kind of a threefold answer. So among the parent partners and the agency staff, working within the agencies, the 346 clinics I'm talking about, yes, definitely, because they're seeing that it makes a difference in terms of their work. They're seeing that the team approach is necessary, and this is a professional who's helping to take things off of their hands. In the child welfare sector specifically, though, we haven't been met with that much enthusiasm. There is more of a tendency to see the parent partner as directly competing with the care managers. And so there, you know, we still are dealing with that. In the managed care healthcare organizations, both the for-profit and not-for-profit, it's mixed. And we don't know yet, because managed care is still sort of getting its toehold as to what it's going to offer and where parent partners are going to fit in. But by and large, they've been very open to it and see this as just a way to expand the workforce, because they're motivated to increase access. And a good way to increase access is to have parent partners out there that are working with the families in their community. So I think managed care is probably going to be a friendly partner in this, but it sort of remains to be seen. So, I want to thank you once more.
Thank you.